You're listening to a program produced in 2011 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of L.A. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To learn more about Aloud, please go to our website, www.aloudla.org. I'm very pleased to introduce Leslie Brody, whom I met years ago through the Sundance Writers Fellow. She's a marvelous writer. She won the Penn Center USA West Prize and an NEA Fellowship and several awards for her playwriting. She's the author of the memoir Red Star Sister and is a tenured professor at the University of Redlands. And her new book, which we'll be talking about tonight, is Irrepressible, The Life and Times of Jessica Mitford. In her earlier memoir, Red Star Sister, Leslie elegantly chronicled her life as a young woman from a Long Island suburb who came of age during the war in Vietnam. She was lauded at the time for her crisp writing and captivating honesty, and her book explored, as she put it, the sense of the utopianism and the complicated vision of country and self that dazzled so many of us in the age we held in common. So it's really no surprise that Leslie Brody fixed on Jessica Mitford as a subject for her next book, a biography. Mitford was a woman who lived up to her ideals, the dreams of her youth, and someone whom Leslie Brody admired deeply for her spirited life and principled accomplishment, and for her sense of humor and her style. Jessica Mitford was, in the words of Leslie Brody, quote, an investigative journalist, civil rights activist, vivid raconteur, and champion of outsiders and underdogs. Admirers and detractors use the same words to describe her: muckraker, subversive, mischief maker, tease, and nuisance, unquote. Irrepressible is a beautifully written book and an excellent biography, and I agree with the San Francisco Chronicle that Brody has, quote, made the world a better place by telling this saga. In preparing Irrepressible, Brody was given unprecedented access to the family archives by Jessica Mitford's daughter, and I'm sure we'll hear more about her research for this work as she discusses Irrepressible with one of LA's own great and irrepressible journalists, Pat Morrison. Pat, as you know, is a writer and columnist for the Los Angeles Times, host of the daily Pat Morrison Public Affairs on KPCC. She's won 6 Emmys and 6 Golden Mike Awards as founding host and commentator on Life and Times Tonight. And her 101 television interview subjects include just a host of great people: Salman Rushdie, Frank Gehry, Ray Bradbury, Joan Didion, and many more. And her column is a regular feature in our household. We love listening to her radio show. We are honored to have her here tonight with Leslie Brody. Please welcome Leslie Brody and Pat Morrison. Thank you.
Thank you, Louise, and thanks everybody for being here. The library is one of the great assets of Los Angeles, and the Aloud series is one of the great gifts that the library gives to us all. Now, like many of you, I discovered Jessica Mitford through the book The American Way of Death, and then I discovered Jessica Mitford herself through Leslie Brody's wonderful book, and it really kind of shocks me to think that I was here in California at the same time Jessica Mitford was alive, and I didn't meet her. I know a couple of you in the audience did. I didn't know her, but the idea that we would have overlapped like that and I would have missed the opportunity. She's one of my dinner table people from history. You know, you want Oscar Wilde and Abe Lincoln and Jessica Mitford there, but then they'd all be talking over each other, so you couldn't hear a thing anybody would have to say. Jessica Mitford was to the American funeral industry what Rachel Carson was to DDT. And as you will hear, there's a great deal to that, but there's also a great deal more to this character, to the story of Decca and her life before she wrote this book, the influences on her. She was the sister of the woman who is still Her Grace, the Dowager Duchess of Devonshire. 2 of her sisters were Nazi sympathizers or Nazis themselves. Her family was a family of eccentric aristocrats, and she inherited some of this and didn't hesitate to play that card when it suited her. but her character was extraordinary. Her strength of character was just as great. And Leslie Brody is here to tell us all about the irrepressible Jessica Mitford. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Pat.
Well, first we heard a little bit about your background, but how did you find Jessica Mitford as a subject for scrutiny in your book?
Okay. Well, I lived in San Francisco in the 70s, and I was working, I got there first, and I was working on an underground newspaper, and Decca was, of course, a great diva. She was the icon of investigative journalism, and, you know, you didn't work on a, you know, this was our internet, right, the underground newspaper, and everyone wanted to meet her. Everyone had, you know, heard about her. Many people had been to her amazing parties, you know, stunning parties that she would give. I never got invited to a party, but I did find a job at one point in the San Francisco College of Mortuary Science. And
were you a plant?
No, but I imagined I was. I would sit there in the during the day and I would dream of writing, you know, poetry at the time or plays or whatever I hoped eventually to become, you know, and I because nobody ever walked into the library. The library was absolutely abandoned. So it was just me and, you know, musty volumes about, you know, embalming, and it smelled of formaldehyde. And you would walk out behind the library there, you'd see these kind of gallon jugs full of red liquid. And it was a great place to do your work. And one day, I remember I was looking, you know, just bored, and I looked through the drawers, and there was this folder on Jessica Mitford. And, you know, wow, I could, you know, do a little investigative muckraking myself, but it was empty, I'm sorry to tell you. But I always felt that our lives kind of ran on a parallel track. And when I decided I was, you know, I had written a memoir, and I swore I'd never write another memoir. I never wanted to write the word I again. And it seemed like a normal progression to write a biography if you're a nonfiction writer and you're interested in, you know, in the form and in, you know, that kind of prose writing. So I had started to think about who I wanted to write about. I made a list of about seven people, and I had this idea. I was really interested in how people kept to the dreams of their youth, and not in a kind of Disney-like way, but, you know, the sort of overcame all the vicissitudes that, you know, rise up to meet you over the course of your life. And she was laughing till the day she died. I mean, she was just, she was a subversive and a joker and a trickster. And she's at the top of my list. I started to do some investigation, and the rest of the list just dropped away.
Do you want to tell us who was on the list, or would
everybody
it hurt their
asks?
Feelings?
Everybody asks. Emma Goldman. I was interested.
Emma Goldman doesn't strike me as a really funny.
She wasn't subject. Funny. No, she wasn't funny. You know, actually, the rest of the list wasn't nearly as interesting. So.
Now, this is a woman, even though she lived here in California and did her major work in California in the United States, she was still, for all of the fact that her mother lamented her lost accent and her American skin, ultimately, she was English. She was an eccentric. Her family owned an island. And to be an eccentric in a family like this is really to stand out. She was a red Deb. Her politics were pronounced. You've got a little bit to read to us about what kind of character she was. But first, let's look at a picture of her when she's a little girl. You get her whole character from this picture.
All right. Well, I'll make my way there. Let's see. Oops. Okay,
yeah.
There she is.
Do you want to tangle with that?
Yeah, she is something.
So read us a little passage, and then you can tell us more about her as a girl and what formed her character.
Okay. Okay, this is the very beginning of the book. Soon after Jessica Mitford moved with her family to Swinbrook House in Oxfordshire, she began to plot her escape from it. She was 12 years old, already an autodidact, well aware of world events, and with a practical sense concerning certain economic currents. That year, it was 1929, she wrote a letter to her family's London bank requesting that a new kind of account be opened on her behalf, and she provided specifications. In reply, she received the following, written in handsome script by an unknown clerk. Dear Madam, We are pleased to acknowledge receipt of your 10 shillings to open your running away account, passbook number 437561 enclosed. We beg to remain, dear madam, your obedient servants, Drummonds. Later in life, she would recite those phrases as evidence of another world. Few things must have seemed less Californian than that letter. She delighted in the contrast between the way things were done and said during her youth among the British aristocracy, including their obedient servants, and her more than 50 years in the American West. "Bank of America's not your obedient servant," she once cracked on camera in her best Lady Bracknell at the Kremlin on hashish tone of voice. Rather marvelous, isn't it? "I was never at all attracted to the life my mother imagined for us," she said in the same interview. Her running away fund began as a direct response to her mother's refusal to let her attend the local grammar school. She kept that Drummonds account active for 7 years, applying to it any gifts, small wages, and spare shillings. Then at the age of 19, with £50 saved, she set off to the Spanish Civil War to fight fascism.
What a start in life. And this is a mother who sent her laundry to Harrods to be done, right?
Right.
So you can imagine the contrast. And yet, in this family, she was the second youngest daughter, is that right?
That's right.
Of six. And so she struggled to distinguish herself mm-hmm. among all these beautiful and eccentric mm-hmm. women. And running away to the Spanish Civil War not only cemented her politics, but her independence.
That's correct. In fact, the mother not only sent her laundry to Harrods, but she ordered fresh new currency from Harrods. She didn't like to use bills that were already used. So she would send her used bills to Harrods, and they would send back very fresh bills to her.
What was the stamp of her politics that she wanted to go to what we would call a public school instead of being privately educated when she was a very little girl? I mean,
right.
That picture is just so formidable. You can see her doing that 60 years later in mm-hmm. life.
Well, would you like to look at the other sisters and then we could compare
them? Yes,
let's
take a look at the other sisters. They were swans, all of them.
Okay, that's the best. Every year, the family would pose in the exact same place and in the same position, and they would hold the animals that they had that year. Everyone had a different dog or, you know, sometimes a rabbit or a hamster or whatever. And so this here, Deck is about 4 years old there. And on our left, that's the Muv, the mother. They called her Muv. And then going clockwise, it's Nancy, the eldest sister, then Tom.
This is Nancy Mitford, the writer, too, whose work I'm sure you're familiar with.
And then Pam, the second sister, who became a kind of farmer, then the father, they called Farve. And then there's the Duchess of Devonshire down there.
The littlest one.
And then Decca. And then Unity, who fell in love with Hitler and attempted suicide.
Oh, who wouldn't?
Yeah. And then Diana, who was considered the beauty of her generation. And if we just go forward, we see what they look like a couple of years later. They are stunning. Oh, there's... okay, there. And so they're all in the same position again. And I won't go around again, but you can see... they're trying to be serious for the picture, and they're holding. And there's Decca, and the second one, the brunette, the second one on the bottom. I'm sorry. Could you repeat your question?
just the what shaped her politics in
okay.
this family of privilege?
All right. She was very close to her brother, and her brother was, you know, educated at Eton, and Decca really wanted to go to Eton, but of course only boys were allowed into Eton, and Eton was where they turned you into a leader of men and a ruler of the universe, you know, or of the empire. And Decca just wanted to go because she wanted to get out of the house, away from her sisters, and she wanted to read. She loved to read. And her brother would bring her back books. I mean, she read Balzac, she read Flaubert. And everybody laughed at her when she read because they thought she was very stuck up and she didn't like sporty things or horseback riding. And she wanted to listen to, you know, music. And they, you know, she became convinced that what she had to do was set herself against these sisters who were such, you know, Philistines. And so one sister, Unity, was really just in her character. Unity was a groupie. She was like a Manson girl. And she was the one who fell in love
with
Hitler.
That's a very apt comparison considering her future, yes.
Thank you. Yeah, and but Deck and she were very, very close. She was her favorite sister. And she was Unity was 2 years older than Decca. Unity was from 1933, and a little bit even earlier, she was obsessed with fascism for its power, for its consolidation of power, for its, you know, fancy uniforms and spruce young men. And Decca had been reading all about World War I and the, you know, atrocities of World War I, and she just set herself against Unity's politics. And from then on, they shared a room up at the top of the house they lived in, and this is great. The kids both had diamond rings, of course. They etched into the window pane of the room they shared, Unity etched in with her diamond a swastika, and Decca etched in a hammer and sickle. You can still see it.
And on her way to the Spanish Civil War, she, as the Edwardians would say, met her fate, met the man who would be her first husband.
Yes. Esmond Romilly was a third cousin, and he was, you know, legend in her family. Everyone said, you know, you have to stay away from the Romillys. They gamble. You know, they're always wanting to borrow money. And, of course, this was just so attractive to Decca. Also, they're atheists. At least the sons are.
And Churchill's nephew.
And Winston Churchill's nephews. And there were two of them. Esmond had a brother, too, Giles. And so she had heard all these stories. So, of course, the more she heard about them, the more she was attracted. And Esmond went at the age of 17. He lied about his age and said he was 18. He ran away to fight in the Spanish Civil War. He wrote a very famous book about it, Boadilla, which was about a battle in which everyone died except for three men. It was an English battalion. And the three men included one Esmond. And he returned. You know, at the age of 18, he was already a hardened veteran from the Spanish Civil War. And when he returned to kind of, his family was, you know, like, you know, we don't really think we want you back. And so he went to stay with a distant cousin who was also a distant cousin of Decca's. When she heard he was there, she made a beeline. And that very night that they met, she was fascinated. Love at first sight for both of them, apparently. And she asked him over the, you know, roast chicken with bread sauce, you know, are you going back to the Spanish Civil War? And if so, would you take me with you?
Very romantic. Now, the curious combination with her was always that she didn't hesitate to use her aristocratic roots or the fact that she was an honorable, even though she was also very devoted to communism and communistic causes, although the way they manifested themselves later was a source of some disillusionment. Mm-hmm. So here's a woman who sort of played both sides. She wanted to be the grand lady when it suited her, but she also was the rebel. And she and Esmond, after the Spanish Civil War episode, they ran away to America, but they also stayed at some of the greatest houses in America.
Yes. She was fascinated by some of these great houses, and you know, she would write home things like, "Oh, you know, Mrs. von Rensselaer has very fine netting over all her windows, you know, to prevent the mosquitoes getting in," because she was absolutely shocked by the weather in America. I mean, that was like the first thing that really blew her mind, and the summers in New York, And Esmond also was writing home these very funny stories about, for example, Eugene Meyer, who is Catherine Meyer or Kay Meyer
Graham's
father, who owned the Washington Post before Kay Graham did. You know, Esmond said that he had a fat stomached leader of men who drank badly paced liquors. I mean, it was like, I didn't think what he meant was, you know, he didn't space them. He just kept drinking all night. So, and they actually loved each other, the Esmond and Kay Graham's father. They would walk around each other figuring out how to exploit one another for, you know, whatever they could get. So,
what was it? I mean, when they were in America, they were the object of great attention and scrutiny. And even though they worked in a restaurant and a bar, they were still, you know, the English eccentrics, the English aristocrats who come to the colonies.
Yeah, I think it was because it was the end of the Depression. They seemed very glamorous. They were obviously in love. And Eugene Mayer gave them a column, and they would write their adventures, and they would be these incredible illustrations that would accompany the columns. And
do we have a picture? Yeah. Well, we have a picture of them working in the restaurant in
Miami. Okay, good. Okay, thank you. This is them in New York. Okay. And this was obviously a posed picture for a reporter, and there was a column. You know, they were celebrities. They were beautiful, they were young, and they were like out of a screwball comedy because they had this companionate marriage, and they just seemed like equals, and they were giddy, and people loved to read about them. And they were English. There was something, you know, it was like My Man Godfrey kind of thing. There we go. I love this. Two youthful escapists who fled to America with a song in their heart. And here they are. It says, we talked...
Fast and long?
I can't even read it. Thank you. Could you read it?
We talked fast and long, and then he said we might go to America without the £3, which I assume is the fee.
Yeah.
And finally we sailed.
Yeah, thanks. They had this idea originally that they would do a lecture tour and kind of, you know, con the rubes in America, the hicks, you know, with lectures like, you know, what the Prince of Wales is really like, and you know what a Deb eats for dinner, and it turned out that the Americans were a little bit smarter than they thought, and nobody really wanted to pay to hear that.
This is like the modern iteration of Mark Twain's Duke and Count.
That's right.
on the Mississippi.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And so, is there a picture of them working at the bar? Was it the bar in the restaurant?
Yeah, there they are. They're making cocktails in. In the Miami was the name of the, I see there's a typo, in Miami at the Roma Italian restaurant. Esmond, when in New York, Esmond decided that he needed a career. And he wanted to, you know, he was a writer. He was 19 years old. He'd already written two books, Boadilla, and he'd written a memoir with his brother about growing up in England and going to a boys' school and what that was like. Wellington was the name of the public school he went to. Anyway, in New York, he decided that he would become a bartender. And so he learned how to, and they would try them all out at home, of course. So when they got to Florida, he applied and, you know, got the job as the bartender of the Miami Roma restaurant. And Decca became the bookkeeper. And eventually she was able to be the bookkeeper for the Communist Party in Northern California. She got her training.
I hope they didn't show any profits.
Never, actually. Not a penny.
How did she fit with pre-war America, where you had the Lindbergh, you know, keep us out of war movement? She was hearing from her family at the same time about what was going on. Yeah. Her sister's involvement with Hitler. How did she mesh in this country politically?
Right. Wherever she went, she was the gallant British gal. You know, war clouds were gathering. And eventually, I mean, in 1940, after the Nazis invaded Norway, then Czechoslovakia, Norway, and then Holland, and then Esmond said, well, I guess I'm going to go enlist. And the U.S., of course, is not involved in the war until 1941. And so he had to go to Canada, which, you know, was the closest place he could go to enlist. And so while he went to Canada, meanwhile, Decca had become pregnant with her daughter, whose name is Dinky. And Constancia, named after a Spanish Civil War heroine, but they called her Dinky for a number of reasons that I can tell you. But and so while Esmond was in Canada, so of course Decca becomes a kind of icon of, you know, the brave young British woman and standing in for all the brave British people who were suffering the Blitz and all sorts of things. And she's always, to answer your question, I'm sorry, I've gone on.
No,
but to
not
answer
at all.
Your question, she was always, advocating for America's involvement in the fight against the Nazis. And as she had since the Spanish Civil War, she opposed the Lindbergh faction and really tried her best to encourage everyone and to work with the United Front.
And she was even invited to the White House. She was a very well-connected woman even in this country. And even got invited to the White House? Do I remember that correctly?
Oh, well, the White House story is after Esmond dies, so we're jumping ahead.
Sorry.
He does die in... he joins in 1940, and in 1941, he's sent to Britain and he's the navigator in a fighter plane. There's the fighter pilot and the navigator, and they went down. He'd been going out on missions, and it was just a horrible thing. There were like 10 pilots in a row who went down in one after another. And so even getting into your plane, the chances were that you weren't going to survive that trip. They were going and dropping bombs in Germany and coming back. And it was winter, and it's just the weather over the English Channel was so awful. And his plane went down, and he was never found. The weather was so awful, the storms were so bad, and the seas were so terrible. So she received notice of this just as she was about to go to England to join him. And she had already given birth, and she had a child who was about a year old then. And, the telegram came to the door. The man carrying the telegram came with the telegram to the door. And, just as she was really virtually leaving to go catch a boat, and the boats were very dangerous, the boats were being bombed, but, she was prepared to go over there, and the news came. And very soon afterwards, Churchill came to the United States to confer with Roosevelt, and this was after Pearl Harbor, and it was a very famous visit at Christmas of 1941. And because he was related to her, of course, and, everybody was so interrelated anyway, but Esmond Romilly was his nephew, and he asked Decca to come to the White House to see him. And there's a very famous story where Churchill's at the White House waiting, and they sent two FBI agents to come over to the house where she was living at the time, and they came in and looked for her, and she wasn't there. And so the FBI guys asked, where is she? We want to take her to meet Roosevelt and Churchill at church today. It's Christmas Day. And Virginia Durr, who was Decca's hostess and, an amazing civil rights activist herself later she said, well, it's going to take more than the FBI, Churchill, and Roosevelt to get Decca into church. So she disappeared for a while, but eventually she went to visit Churchill at the White House, and he told her that that Esmond had gone down into the British Channel, and he tried to give her $500 because he knew that she was really didn't have any money without Esmond there, and she refused to take it. She said it was blood money, and Churchill sent his secretary running after her down the block and saying, really, just take this for Churchill and the British people, And she took it, and she gave some to a charity and some to the daughter of Virginia Durr to buy a horse. So she didn't want to have anything to do with what she called her filthy fascist family back in England.
Now, you have a very funny account of how she was doing war work, in a manner of speaking. She ended up in a typing pool and managed to finagle. Well, you tell the story.
Well, I don't know. It's she got a job in the WPA as one of the government girls. And, everybody probably knows now the government girls, when all the men went to war, women went to Washington, D.C., and they got these jobs in government. And Decca got a job for the OPA, the Office of Price Administration, which she seriously believed in rationing. She really believed in you know, that people had to, you know, cut back to make it you know, easier for everyone to have what they needed. And so she was an investigator, and you know, she'd never really worked a real job before. And she was, first of all, she couldn't pass the typing test. She was categorized as a sub-eligible typist. Is that what you mean?
And then how she got the other girls too.
Oh, yeah. And then she said, well, I discovered this really lovely thing called the typing pool, which I just dove into. And I would, you know, I would take, she, her boss would give her all these pages to type, and she couldn't type. But she had this wonderful accent and this great bearing, and, you know, and people were sort of terrified of her. I mean, she was a beautiful young woman with this great hauteur, you know, and she would just go into the typing pool and she'd say, I need this by 5 p.m.
And she would spy on people, right, to make sure that they were observing their rationing.
She was an investigator. That's what she would do. She would her most famous spying experience was with her with Bob Truhoff, whom she would marry. He was also working at the OPA, and a year later they would both move to California and they would marry. But he was a labor lawyer, so he was making regulations at the OPA while she was an investigator to see if people were obeying them. But they did, they went on a stakeout one day. And the idea was that they were going to see if people were using people weren't supposed to use gas for pleasure driving, right? You weren't supposed to go anywhere except places you absolutely had to go. So they had this stakeout one night in January, Washington, D.C. It's icy cold. They got nice thermos of hot coffee, and they sat outside the Mayfair Hotel, which had this very famous nightclub in it. And, you know, to see if anybody was going to drive up to the door of the Mayfair Hotel and go into the nightclub. And they, you know, they just drank their coffee, and it's getting later and later. Nobody's coming. Suddenly they hear, you know, the crunch of car tires, and it's a limousine, you know, it's chauffeur-driven limousine. And they just went berserk. You know, they went out, and they caught the people who were getting out of the car, who, of course, were the Norwegian ambassador who had, amnesty, what's it called?
Diplomatic immunity.
Right, yeah. And his wife. And Decca said, we only knew it was his wife because she said she was, you know. But they were able to, of course, immunity protected them. But
was it her daughter Dinky who gave you access to her files
yeah.
and letters? Why did she want this written? Why did she want you to write it?
Oh, you know, she's an amazing person, and herself a real. Stalwart of the civil rights years in America. She was married for a time to James Forman, who was the leader of SNCC at one time. But Dinky herself has been a, you know, an amazing activist and advocate of open sourcing, and believes deeply that in transparency, and that, like her mother, that things just should come out, they should be known. And she said, well, I wasn't going to write it myself. And people for 20 years have been trying to write this story. I will give you just, when Decca died in 1996, her husband, Bob Truhoff, was still alive, and he wanted to find a biographer. And at the time, they were thinking, you know, a kind of authorized biography, whatever that means. They asked Christopher Hitchens, who had been a friend of Decca's, and he used to come over for dinner. A great story with Decca is that she had stopped smoking years before. She'd met Hitchens, but then she stopped smoking. Okay, so he came over for dinner. She liked to have him come over to dinner and smoke over dinner, just so she could smell the smoke and like blow it into her face. He said that apparently, okay, this is secondhand, I don't know, gossip. He said that he couldn't do it because she was too much like his mother. He wasn't the right person to do it. Other people have volunteered to do it, but Dinky said, well, it's out there. She has, all her papers are at the Ohio State University and also in Austin at the Texas University.
Which is a tremendous repository for historical papers.
Exactly. And she used to sell those, you know, once she learned that you could sell them by the pound, she tried to interest anybody who wanted, you know, because she saved everything. And when she would sell them by the pound, she would throw in grocery receipts and anything that she could to make the price higher. She liked money. Remind me what we were saying.
We're just talking about why she chose you.
Oh, yeah. Well, I don't know. Okay. She read Red Star Sister. And she thought that my sensibility would have matched her mother's, which, of course, was a great, you know, very flattering thing to hear. She said, you know, try it. You know, I mean, Decca had great stamina, and she did a million things. And if you read the book, you'll see every page there's another adventure. It was very hard for me to keep up with her. It took me a long time, and I had to go slowly. She was very funny, and it just kept my interest because I was always laughing through the whole thing.
Take us through, here she is in the war, and she's the plucky little English woman, mm-hmm. and then comes the McCarthy era, and then she comes to California. What was she like in that period, and how was her politics solidified, I suppose?
Right. She and Esmond always thought that they would join the Communist Party, but they didn't actually like the people who were in the Communist Party because they thought they were prigs or they were...
They put an emphasis on communists instead of party.
Yeah, that's right. That's exactly right. So when she came to town, she kind of blew them away. She started off, the first thing she did to kind of announce that there was a new comrade in town was to have this party in San Francisco, where everybody, it was a fundraiser, and the first person who raised $100 would get a lifetime subscription to the People's World. And Decca just set her sights on that. And it was her party, so from the moment you walked in the door, it was like 5 cents if you wanted your coat hung up, otherwise it went on the floor. It was 5 cents for a drink. It was a quarter for a dance. It was that she'd turn up the music, and it was a quarter if you wanted the music turned down. It was a quarter for toilet paper, and then it was a quarter if you wanted her to open the door into the toilet. So she quickly earned her $100. And actually, there's a funny story about the People's World. Years after both she and Bob had left the party, they were still getting the People's World because it was a lifetime subscription.
Well, you write about her communism. It's her own interpretation of communism. But she married Bob Truhoff, who was a Jewish lawyer, to her mother's dismay, or to her family's dismay. Mm-hmm. And they didn't know what was worse, he was Jewish or he was American.
Right.
So,
And
so here she's a woman who kind of defined her own terms, what she thought a communist should be.
Yeah.
And yet what we remember her for is not so much her personal politics or even, you know, the larger politics, but this particular book, The American Way of Death.
Right.
I'd like to know how she came to it because, of course, years before, Evelyn Waugh had written The Loved One about Forest Lawn. She had, of course, dealt with deaths in her own family, mm-hmm. including the deaths of two of her children. So what was it that got her attention, her sustained attention, that made this book and made her mark?
Okay. Well, there's a couple of answers to that, of course. First of all, the Evelyn Waugh book includes reference to Esmond. One of the characters is very much like him, and she was a family friend of Evelyn Waugh's. Her son, Nicky, who was her second son, was killed by a bus when he was 12 years old. It was a great tragedy. She never got over it. And also was never able to write about him in any of her books. In a very strange way, she just kind of selected him out of all her books. She wrote a number of memoirs and was never able to address him or his death. And so the other children show up, but not Nicky. And Nicky's funeral was one of those funerals where the funeral director takes over and there's friends remember there was a gigantic white wreath and a satin child's coffin, and it was an open coffin, and you know, she and her husband were just revolted by it. I mean, it was just a terrible experience, and she absorbed it. She doesn't use that. She never says that that has anything to do with her writing The American Way of Death. Her friends say that, the ones who were there. She says that Bob was working in a he was a labor union lawyer, and that the death benefits for the widows of the members normally, and there was mostly men in this labor union that he, particular that he's talking about, that there was just enough to cover the funeral. That it seemed whatever it was, the funeral directors had a funeral that would just be covered by that amount, and so it interested. It interested Bob enough to think about joining this funeral co-op that was starting in Berkeley, the Berkeley Funeral Co-op, and it was like a pioneering effort where people would pay a little money up front, and then they would get a reasonable funeral down the line because everybody was joining in. You know how co-ops work, right? So,
gee, it sounds like healthcare.
Yeah, and it really worked, So, but it was very threatening to the funeral industry, who were unregulated and really could pretty much do what they liked, and who were advertising something at that point, that we in America really need to have an American way of death that was every bit as impressive as our American way of life. And those were fighting words for her. And she first wrote an article, and then Bob actually was really trying to get somebody to write a book about this, and said, Decca, this is your meat. You can do this. And she said, I'll only do it if you do it with me. And he took a year off work, and they wrote it together.
Is there a passage about that you'd like to read?
Yeah. Some pictures up there too.
Dorothy Parker was fascinated by this sort of thing and subscribed to mortuary magazines, but she never took it any farther, which is unfortunate because a Dorothy Parker book about the funeral industry would certainly have been worth reading.
Okay, so after Bob convinces her, the timing was right, and appealed to Decca's sense of the absurd. In her life, she'd seen more than her share of death and dying, but here was a kind of way to dominate the subject. The ghoulish and morbid lent itself most naturally to puns and teases. There are plenty of underdogs here to defend, secrets to uncover, and who wouldn't want to write about morticians? They were, in her opinion, a very lively group. Dissension has begun to spread in the ranks of the living, is how she began her article. This is the article she wrote in advance of the book. Then she proceeded to condemn the high costs of funerals. She was lucky enough to get some killingly good quotes, like this one from one past president of the Funeral Directors of San Francisco, who said, "In keeping with our high standard of living, there should be an equally high standard of dying." An ideal segue to Decca's explanation of the industry's cutthroat nature. The year was 1958. It should be borne in mind, this is from her book, that the funeral industry faces a unique economic situation in that its market is fixed or inelastic. There are only a certain number of deaths each year, and the funeral directors must compete with each other to obtain their share of the business. The television industry touts the advantage of a TV set in every room. Auto salesmen advocate several cars to each family. Cigarette manufacturers urge a carton for the home and one for the office. But in the funeral business, it's strictly one to a customer. And the number of customers is limited by circumstances beyond the control of the industry. Should I go on for a little bit
more, yeah.
Eventually, a small progressive Southern California magazine called Frontier bought the article for $40 and published it in November 1958 issue under the title, "St. Peter, Don't You Call Me," meaning I'm too poor to afford a funeral. Decca's curiosity about funerals came naturally. In childhood, the bedroom she had shared with her younger sister Debo had overlooked a cemetery. The two girls, Debo says, were forbidden to watch funerals, which of course we always did. "Jessica and I once fell into a newly dug grave," Debo recalled. to the delight of their elder sister, Nancy, who pronounced that as a result, they should have bad luck the rest of their lives. 4 years after Decca's article on funerals appeared, she returned to the subject, and in stark defiance of Nancy's prediction, very little bad luck attended it.
Now, this was a book that she researched by doing things like going to the gift shop at Forest Lawn.
Yes, okay. Here's a yes. And reading from magazines, I'll just read you this just little thing. Like Mortuary Management. She adored the magazine Mortuary Magazine Management. And there was another one called Casket and Sunnyside, which I still don't understand.
Even casket is one of those words they contrived so they didn't have to use the word coffin.
Exactly.
She rebelled against
yeah,
that.
It's like a little jewel case, a casket, isn't it? And the Mortuary Management, in which she'd find editorials like Children's Funerals, A Golden Opportunity to Build Goodwill. And you know, and she was just delighted by all the kinds of phony clothes, you know, half clothes that you would see, you know, shoes that would only be cover the toes, and you know, tuxedos that were only the bib front, and she just she loved the ghoulishness of it as well. And in fact, when she got into writing about various embalming methods, you know, she really, it was the one part of her book that, in fact, her editors and her publishers balked at. They weren't interested in, they thought that she'd really gone over the top and that she was being vulgar. And, you know, she was absolutely convinced that this was the part that people would most want to know about, because there was, there's no rule, there was no law that said that people had to be embalmed, but funeral directors insist, you know, would imply that it was a health hazard and that, you know, terrible things would happen, you know, epidemics would you know, overcome the United States.
It really was shocking, because at the time, funeral directors, mortuaries didn't have to post prices the way they do now. It was really a captive market. And this book, when it appeared, it really did have sort of the impact of Silent Spring in terms of the American funeral industry, the reaction to it. This, it appeared the year that John F. Kennedy was assassinated. Robert F. Kennedy had read the book, so when he was in Dallas, he chose a cheaper coffin for his brother. He decided it would be a closed coffin for a number of reasons, including the fact that this book talks so much about the artifice of death. You said in your book she was used to notoriety, but now she had fame.
Yes, and money. And she just, she loved it. I mean, she took to it immediately, of course. And it just gave her the opportunity to do even more investigating and muckraking. And also, she and Bob had been in the party until 1958. And when Nikki had died in 57, and although she was no longer really active in the party, I would say that because of her son's death, she wasn't going anywhere. She wasn't going to do anything. She was just going to sit still. And then when she was, you know, when she and Bob started to like join the world again, they left the party, but not with any sense of repudiation. They said, well, it's just, you know, that was what we did then. This is what we're doing now. We're moving forward. And when she became very famous after the book, it gave her an opportunity. She called herself an ex-Red Menace. And of course, the funeral directors, a very powerful industry, and they would, of course, you know, try to red smear her and try to bring up all the stuff about her past to damn the book. And she just delighted in having her, you know, having debates with people about the book and about her past life. And she never hid anything. Do you have something there that you...
Well, it's, I mean, just the some of the reaction to him, looking for the page about how they called her, you know, that we have all American funerals and not Soviet funerals. And how dare she write about this? And
yes, your friend.
Do you have that? Congressman Utt, who is an Orange County congressman, I think, who was writing about that. Do you have that right in front of you?
I actually only go up to the part about, somebody have a number?
263? Sold.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's. Did you find it there?
No, I haven't looked.
So, well, I'll just say that the managing director of the National Selected Mortician said she wanted to substitute communist Russian-style funerals for our fine American ones. And this congressman, James Utt, who is an amazing congressman and one of those that Orange County was legendary for, denounced her on the floor of the House of Representatives and said that she's hiding behind the commercial aspects of the mortician in the cemeteries and mausoleums where our dear departed are commemorated. She's striking another blow at the Christian religion. So, and the mortuary directors didn't know what happened.
That's right.
Didn't know what hit them.
That's right. And, you know, and she had... You know, how lucky could she be? You know, she found these unbelievable quotes. And I'll just read you another quote here from, well, first, she and Bob found this title. And, of course, it's a beaut, right? The American Way of Death. And this was direct from Howard C. Rather, an unsuspecting mortuary executive who, with that boosterism denoting an industry without natural enemy... yet, pronounced, funerals are becoming more and more a part of the American way of life.
No irony there.
No, none at all.
How profoundly did her book change funeral practices?
Eventually regulations were changed. It took a long time, though, but it did change laws. And those laws have kind of slipped back over the years, and funerals are more and more a part of the American way of life again. But I think there's also a lot of, you know, fancy cremation, too, expensive cremation as well. But, you know, you can get taken out into a boat with when you're dead, into the sea, and people can, you know, have fireworks. And
you can also get pressed into a diamond.
You can. Oh, she would love
you
that.
I was thinking exactly she would love
she
to have
so
been a
that.
Diamond. Three she quarters of a
it.
Carat for $9,000 because it's carbon. All you do is pressurize it again and you turn into a diamond. So I'm sure she would have loved that part of it. What was her funeral like?
Okay. She made a mistake. She rarely made these kinds of mistakes when talking to journalists, being the kind of journalist who knew how to go for the jugular herself. But she was joking with someone who didn't have any sense of irony and who asked her what kind of funeral she wanted. And she said, oh, I'd like one. I'd like six horses with plumes and, you know, I'd like a cortege and, you know, I'd like a parade down Market Street.
A Dickensian funeral.
Yeah. And, you know, so they wrote that up, and she always had to say, well, I didn't really mean that. But actually, her funeral was after her death, she had the very least expensive cremation and cremation container. I think it's $49. I say it somewhere in here. And then her ashes were dispersed into the Pacific. But her family, knowing that she really did want to have that funeral cortege, arranged one for her. So and there's a page. I could read that. Are we ready for that?
Yes.
Her funeral?
Okay.
It reads like David Copperfield.
It's just a page. David Copperfield is long. Okay. All right. During her last months, undertakers had vied for the opportunity to do Jessica, but none of them expected a goodbye note. That privilege alone belonged to Robert Waltrip, president of Service Corporation International. I'm sorry, I have to change into my reading glasses. I can't. Thank you. I can't do bifocals. Okay. All right. In a communique sent posthumously by her assistant, Decca encouraged Waltrip to pick up the tab for all goods and services associated with her funeral. She considered this a fair exchange for the free publicity she had provided, and she kept the bill low just to show it could be done. Did I say $49? It's $475, including $15.45 for the cremation container. After that thrifty...
Which is essentially a cardboard box.
That's right. After that thrifty cremation, there were two boisterous memorial services in packed houses, first San Francisco, then London. Some people choose music or readings in advance. Decca designed a comic protest to surprise and lift the mood. She had long theorized that the speakers at funerals too often relied on the word but to combine excellent sentiments with inferior ones. So in her final weeks, Decca secretly charged some friends to object should any of her eulogists wander that way. When a speaker early on in the San Francisco Memorial innocently invoked the offending conjunction, her avenging angels rose to protest, and no more buts did he brute. Once, during an interview, Decca had jokingly expressed a desire for a horse-drawn hearse to carry her corpse. She came to regret those remarks, since her humorless adversaries only flouted them to prove her inconstancy. To her family and army of friends, however, it was a good joke, and knowing how she really would have loved a funeral cortege, they arranged one for her. As the congregation emerged into the lucid San Francisco afternoon, they saw at the curb six black, magnificently plumed horses waiting to draw an ornate and polished antique hearse filled with Mitford memorabilia. A driver in full livery, including top hat, scrambled into his seat. A band of musicians assembled to precede the hearse, and Lisa Pollard on solo saxophone followed behind. As they proceeded along the waterfront, the band played songs in honor of Decca, among these When the Saints Go Marching In, Amazing Grace, and the Internationale.
We'll take your questions in a minute, but I'd like you to tell us just what her last years were like, because she wasn't yet 50 when she wrote this book. Isn't that right?
That's right. Well, let's take a quick look at a picture, if I can figure out how to do this. All right. Oh, well, that's Bob's family. There's a whole part of her life we haven't really talked about, her activism in the South, and there she is. There she is hiking. That's Dinky and Nikki and Ben, the youngest son. There they are again. This is the Duchess of Devonshire at Chatsworth, where she lived at that time with her husband, the Duke. It's the stand-in for Pemberley, for those of you who have seen Pride and Prejudice with Keira Knightley, that gigantic place that Anthony Lane in The New Yorker called the size of a small planet. they are 1959, right before American Way of Death, this family. That's her mother on an island that Decca eventually lived on, purchased.
This was in her family's hands.
And yes. There they are at I love that dog. So gorgeous. That's Nancy, Sister Nancy. That's a really nice one of Decca and Bob in San Francisco. Bob was running for district attorney. He didn't get elected, but he gave the guy a run for his money. That's the island. That's Decca in her 50s. So there you see her in her 50s. She was doing a lot of lecturing. She continued to write a book almost every 2 years for 20 years. She wrote about eight more books. That's Dinky's marriage. There's Decca in her 70s. That's her son, Ben, who became a piano tuner and used to tune pianos, send them to Cuba. Send a piano to Havana was the name of his organization. And there she is a few years before her death, or maybe just a year. And the photographer told me, I said, what's that story? Why is she? And she said, well, I went over to Decca's house to do a portrait, and Decca said, hey, wait a minute, I've got a mask. And she put it on, said, take my picture. And it's pretty representational.
And we remember her for that one book, but did she think that was the crowning achievement of her, at least her literary life?
It's hard to know what she thought. I think she liked to be thought of as a serious muckraker and writer. And her books about the prison system and the American Way of Birth, she thought were more serious. Well, at least the prison book, Kind and Unusual Punishment, was a very serious book, but it's not a very readable book compared to the others. It has a kind of 60s kind of jauntiness to it, but it doesn't really hone in on the subject as much as you'd like. She wanted to be taken seriously, even though she was always a trickster, and so there was always that conflict in her. But I think in the end she was. And her best books, for my money, are her two memoirs. Hans and Rebels, if you haven't read that, is a brilliant book about growing up in England and then going off to the United States, that period that we talked about in the beginning.
Called Daughters and Rebels here because nobody would know what an honorable is.
That's right, yeah. And the other one is Final Conflict, which is about her life in the Communist Party in the United States. Great social history and really interesting in a period that I think has been ignored a lot. And the book didn't do well. And people really didn't want to hear about it. So,
did she become an American citizen?
Yes, she did. Yeah, she
did. Why?
So she could join the Communist Party.
Isn't that America?
The Communist Party was not about to accept anybody who the government could had anything could hold anything about over. You know, if they threatened you with deportation, maybe you would tell something on somebody else. That's what they thought. So you had to be, fully fledged and have all your papers in order if you wanted to join the Communists.
Well, who has some questions about Jessica Mitford, about DECA?
I'd love to hear from anybody who
life.
Knows her.
Somebody, surely. Yes, here, please. Nope.
I'm just curious to know, is there any video on her, film? I'd love to, she's such a character. I'd love to hear her voice. I'd love to see what she looked like. I mean, if I go to YouTube and put in Jessica Mitford, will I find something?
Yes. Great. Yes, you will. In fact, one of the weirdest things you'll find is in the last few years of her life, she joined a rock and roll band, a kazoo band. And not only did she play the kazoo, but she sang, she was their front singer, and she recorded Maxwell's Silver Hammer, which you will find on YouTube if you really have to.
But she enjoyed it.
She had the greatest time. She loved the idea of being a torch singer. She used to pull out like a pair of men's boxer shorts and wipe the sweat from her forehead. She loved it.
There's one right there we go.
I just talked too loud. I just finished reading the Duchess Devonshire's memoirs, Wait for Me, where she talks a little about her sister, Deca, but didn't talk too much about her because she had done her own memoirs. I was wondering if you could just briefly talk a little more about how her relationship with her sisters continued over the years after she moved to America, and particularly in regard to Unity, who tried to commit suicide after the whole thing with Hitler.
Yeah. Okay, well... Deca tried very hard not to believe that Unity was completely converted to Hitler's cause. I mean, she would tell herself all sorts of things. She's really, she's in love with him. She's making, all sorts of excuses. But her sister did try to kill herself. She shot herself with a revolver in September 1940. And... 1939, when Britain declared war on Germany. And afterwards, Unity became kind of childlike. She had this bullet in her head, and she lived for another 8 years. And Deca never saw her again. And she really did, in her writing, it's very poignant, because she remembers them being great allies when they were children, before politics pulled them apart. The other thing is, Deca was always... absolutely desperate for her elder sister Nancy's approbation. Nancy was the person to whom she looked for approval in everything she did, particularly in her writing. And she just loved Nancy, loved her. So and she loved Debo, the youngest sister. They had a hard time, because they didn't follow the same track, but they stayed, sisters. I mean, they loved what was deep in each other, and tried, things came between them, but they, even at the end of their lives, they really, at the end of Jessica's life, she was, Debo was the person she wanted to see.
And her father disowned her.
Yes, he did.
Mm-hmm. Running off and doing these horrible things.
Yeah, he could withstand a lot of insubordination from his daughters. he didn't seem to mind as much when Unity went off to, you know, meet with Hitler, but he didn't like the idea that Decca had run away to be a communist. So, you know, and she said...
Picky.
Yeah, I know. And she said, well, you know, we never expected him to... In the will, he added this clause in every paragraph, except Jessica. So, you know...
Thanks, Dad. over here, yes.
Well, actually, I was going to ask if she inherited any money from the family.
She actually did. It was... She had this lucky streak where people were just making their wills out badly. And so she wasn't supposed to inherit anything from Esmond's family because his mother didn't like her. They had a hard time, and his mother tried to cut her out, but she hadn't done something properly. So in the end, Decca got a bunch of money from Esmond's family. And this is the thing about the island. When her brother Tom, who also died in World War II, right at the end, he died in Burma like a month before the war ended. It's really, you know, all those terrible tragedies. But that one's so sad, you know. And anyway, his father had deeded him an island in Scotland called Inchkenneth. I think that's how you pronounce it. In any case, this Inchkenneth was Tom's property. And because he died... without a will, in Scotland they divide the property up equally among your siblings. So there's nothing the father could do to prevent her inheriting her portion. And then Nancy gave her another portion, so she had kind of the largest portion of the island and bought her other sisters out. And she loved that island. She lived there for a long time in summers, but then she finally sold it as a publicity scheme for Ramparts magazine.
Yes, the ad. Did she have any problem, any cognitive dissonance with being rich and titled and yet a communist and one of the quote-unquote people?
You know, she didn't really live... She lived in a very modest house in Berkeley. She always had a new car. She liked that. And they didn't spend a lot of money. But when her daughter... Dinky told me that like the last year of Decca's life... she said, "Now I want to show you something, Dinky." And they went around to about 10 different, maybe I'm exaggerating. I don't know how many banks, but a number of banks to show Dinky that she'd been piling up money in these different banks. And also there were little caches of money all over the house that she didn't spend. She just saved. She just really liked to have some emergency funds.
And she didn't send it to Harrods for new bills.
No.
There's a question over here.
Yeah, I was just curious if in your book you cover her visit to Unity in Germany and her plan to assassinate Hitler.
Well, I do talk about her plan to assassinate Hitler, and she said that she just wasn't brave enough. This is a woman who's so incredibly brave. So many things she's just walked into the mouth of danger so many times in her life, but she just. She thought that she might have brought a little gun with her when she was about to go visit Hitler and in Germany, and she decided not to take the gun. So she didn't. She said it would have changed the course of history, of course, but I couldn't do it.
One more question do we have? Outstanding. Going once. Going twice. Oh. Hi. There we go, up there, sorry. Can we get over there?
Aaron.
I'm the designee.
All right.
Okay.
I just after today's times, I was interested whether, I mean, we have an American aristocrat writing in Lewis Auchincloss, and certainly the Mitfords were aristocrats from England. Are there any points of contact between... or discontact between Auchincloss and the Mitfords.
Do you know where that's the case? Lewis Auchincloss, who's the writer about it. Didn't you, the name didn't
I'm sorry, I,
appear.
I don't, it doesn't show up in much of any of the literature. Nancy would be more likely to have had connections with him.
And was there one more here? Okay. Okay, two.
Hi, Leslie.
Hi, Erin.
So, you know, the book is wonderful in that it paints Jessica Mitford as this great trickster, adventurer, all that. But I wonder as I read it, what was it about this country that really morally outraged her? Was it the prison system? Was it the fascism of racism in the South? And the whole story of her going through the South, I love. But what was it that really kind of you know, fueled her? Outrage.
Thanks for asking that. All her life she fought fascism, and she saw in the United States, she thought segregation was an extension of fascism. She couldn't believe it. You know, she really loved America in a lot of ways, and she was fascinated by the South. I mean, she lived in Washington, D.C., and then went to Miami, and then traveled around the South later, and was involved in a lot of campaigns to particularly one to free Willie McGee, who was a black man accused falsely of rape, who was eventually lynched after a number of what appeared to be really rigged trials. But and she worked on that campaign with the Communist Party. But she always saw that. She saw that segregation, she thought, was a continuation of fascism. And so she was very, she really engaged with the civil rights movement. And it was really satisfying, I think, to her, although she continued fighting all her life, to see that there was an actual change that, slow development, and that she was part of it. And then her daughter, of course, was very active in the civil rights movement.
But wasn't she upset when her daughter got pregnant by a black man to whom she was not yet married?
That's right. It was the part that she wasn't married because Decca was, as I mentioned, she was really into money, and she thought that Dinky would suffer without that ring on her finger because she didn't really have a career yet. Eventually, Dinky became a nurse and started an amazing clinic at Bellevue Hospital in New York for a pain clinic for palliative care or something like that. And she's just recently retired and works with a West Bank theater company called the Jenin Theater Company. She's going back and forth to... it's actually a Palestinian theater company.
One last question. Was there something? Nope. All right. Well, please thank Leslie Brody, and we want to say something about Mr. L as well.
Aloud Audio is produced by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, Righteous Persons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, City National Bank, K&L Gates, KPMG, the Bujaki Foundation, Susan and David Rosenblum, Wallace Foundation, and Donna and Martin J. Wolfe. Media support provided by KPCC 83.9 FM and KUSC 91.5 FM. Additional support provided by the Council of the Library Foundation and individual Library Foundation members. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.